oily hands on my shoulder blades, shoving me forward, pushing me in a search of the whys. Maybe Mom's right. Maybe my need to map out Will's last moments is a defense mechanism to delay having to deal with the pain. But still, I can't move forward until I fill in the most pressing blanks. What else do I not know about my husband? What else did he not tell me? How many more lies? Mom gives my hand a squeeze. I'm just worried about you, sweetie. That's all. Thanks. Her concern sends up another surge of tears, one that this time I can't blink away. I'm a little worried about me, too. Later that night, after the kitchen is clean and Mom and Dad have headed upstairs for bed, I carry my laptop over to the couch and pull up Will's Facebook page. My husband was not a big fan of social media. Why bother? He'd always say. It's just a place for people to brag and lie about their lives. Like I'm supposed to believe the biggest asshole from high school is now dating a supermodel? Sorry, but I call bullshit. But like pretty much everybody else on the planet, Will had a Facebook page. He just largely ignored it. Dave plops down beside me on the couch, throwing his bare feet up on the coffee table and shoving aside a flower arrangement with his toe. Now I know why so many obituaries include the line, "in lieu of flowers." They're literally everywhere. Solemn springtime arrangements lined up across every horizontal surface, spilling over kitchen counters and mantelpieces, clogging the air with their heady scent.
Maybe we should donate some of these. What do you think?
I glance over. Fine by me. There's a church around the corner and a dozen shelters within 5 miles.
Cool. I'll get James to give me a hand.
A hand with what? James says, coming into the room with a bottle and 3 glasses. He holds the glasses by the stems in one hand and pours with the other, with a surgeon's steadiness, not spilling a drop. Dave tells him about the flowers, and they agree to distribute the first load in the morning. Thanks, I say, taking one of the glasses from James. With my other hand, I gesture to my laptop screen, to the sea of shocked condolence posts jamming up Will's wall. When did people start treating Facebook as a tool to communicate with the dead? Like this one. Will, man, so sorry to hear of your passing. R.I.P., buddy. Do they really think he's going to see it? He never checked his page when he was alive, much less. Unable to finish, I bury my nose in my wine. Dave drapes a palm over my wrist.
Stop torturing yourself, sweetie, and turn off the laptop.
I can't. I'm looking for clues. I open a screen for Will's list of friends. There are 78 of them, and more than 60 of them are mutual. I scroll to the bottom, to the friends we don't have in common, find a handful of colleagues, one of my girlfriend's exes, a neighbor from down the road, the barista from our neighborhood coffee shop. Dave leans in, reading over my shoulder.
What kind of clues are you looking for, Inspector Gadget?
Clues of the Corbin Hayes kind. Dave frowns, and I add, you know, the banker slash bodybuilder I met at the memorial today? The one who told me all those things about Will?
Because of curiosity or suspicion? James says.
I pause to consider my answer, but it doesn't take me long. Yes, curiosity is driving me, but after meeting Corbin, I can't shake the feeling there's more I don't know. If there are more people like Corbin Hayes out there, I want to speak to them. Both. But I'm not going to find anything here. Will hated Facebook, and there's nobody here I don't recognize or can't place. I slam the laptop closed in frustration. James leans back into the couch, resting his wine glass on his flat stomach.
Have you checked the cards?
What cards? He sweeps a palm toward the arrangement on the table, and beyond, to vases standing like soldiers at attention on the kitchen bar.
You must have gotten flowers from everyone you know. Maybe there are a couple here from people you don't know.
Of course, the cards. The ones Mom arranged in the basket on Will's placemat. The ones I couldn't bear to read. I pop off the couch and fetch the basket from the table. James refills the wine glasses, and we sip and sift through the condolences, pausing only to point out a painfully bad illustration or an extra corny text. And there are a lot of both. There must be close to 100 cards here, saccharine messages and religious missives from my and Will's colleagues, old friends and neighbors, aunts and cousins and college classmates, people I haven't seen or heard from in years. Dave holds up a note card covered in green glitter.
Who are Terry and Melinda Phillips?
A.K.A. Melinda Lee, I say, our cousin. His eyes go wide, and his face spreads into a grin.
The one who came to your wedding in a prom dress?
I smile at the memory of my brother's face when Melinda walked up the church steps in her frilly blue concoction. Terry is her third husband, or is it fourth? I've lost count, and it wasn't a prom dress.
It was definitely a prom dress, and it was hideous, not to mention two sizes too small.
He starts describing the dress for James, the lace and the ruffles and the seams stretched to screaming, while I return to the pile. A few cards later, I come across something, a name I've never heard of before, printed underneath the generic florist card message. I twist to face James. Did you go to Hancock? He gives me a funny look. This card says deepest sympathies for your loss, Hancock High School, class of 99. Is that where you went? He shakes his head.
I have never heard of the place. Maybe it's Will's alma mater?
No, Will went to Central. I know, because I pulled it out of him for that surprise trip I planned to Memphis on our first anniversary. Remember?
The trip that never was.
Dave knows Will and I never actually made it to Memphis, and he knows why. And now, I can tell by my brother's expression that he and I are thinking the same thing. Who went to Hancock? And then, his eyes go wide, and he pops off the couch.
Be right back.
He takes off down the hallway and up the stairs, his footsteps thumping overhead. Next to me on the couch, James settles his glass on the side table, slides his phone from his pocket, and begins typing with his thumbs. When Dave returns a few moments later, a t-shirt clutched in a fist, I recognize it from Will's closet. It's his ratty work shirt, the one he wears around the house for gardening and painting, an ancient thing that's ripped and stained and threadbare around the edges. Its letters are faded, but I know what they say before he holds it up for me to see. Hancock Wildcats. I always thought it was just a vintage shirt, a generic one like the kind they sell at Old Navy, but now I make the connection. Why would Will tell me he went to Central if he graduated from Hancock?
Haven't you ever Googled your husband's name?
Dave says. Of course not. Have you?
Yes,
Dave and James say in unison. Maybe this has something to do with his mother dying, I say, still trying to give Will the benefit of the doubt. I know he had to move. Maybe he had to change school districts, too.
Guys?
James grew up in Connecticut, and though he's lived in Savannah for almost a decade, he hasn't quite mastered the use of the word y'all.
You said Will was from Memphis?
I nod, but Dave is more concerned about the card pinched between my fingers.
Does that thing come with a person's name, or the name of the florist?
I check it again, shake my head. FTD.com. I think this is some kind of reference number, though. We can try looking up the order online. James tries again, this time more insistently.
Guys, I... Or we could just call them, Dave says. What if we tell them we need a contact for our thank you cards? I don't know if they'll give it to us, but it's worth a shot.
We can also try the school. They can put us in touch with someone from the class of 99.
Iris!
My name comes out like a shot, and if his insistent tone didn't get my attention, his phone screen in front of my face does.
Look!
I stare at the Google page, search results for Hancock High School, and at the very top, on the very first line of the first listing, is a street address. A chill starts in my chest and creeps down my arms and legs like the start of the flu. 623rd Avenue, Seattle, Washington. I pass the phone to my brother and reach for my laptop. If your offer still stands, I'm booking us on a flight for first thing tomorrow morning. Chapter 12. Miraculously, I sleep the entire 5-hour flight, from the moment we catch air in Atlanta until the captain dips the nose and aims us at Seattle. My body finally overriding my brain, I suppose, and giving in to my exhaustion. We hit a violent pocket of air on the descent, and my eyes snap wide open, not frightened, but aware. Is this what Will first felt, too? All around us, passengers white-knuckle their armrests, Dave included. I know they're thinking of Flight 23, calculating the odds of 2 Seattle-bound flights going down in the same week. And I wonder at my own sense of calm. Why am I not frightened like the others? Are my senses that dulled by grief? The plane jostles and squeaks, then evens out, and the passengers melt back into their seats. Dave reaches across me to shove up the window shade, and the bright light burns my eyes.
Welcome back. I was worried I might have to carry you off.
Wouldn't be the first time, I say, thinking of the time sophomore year in which Joey McIntosh showed me how to funnel beer until I passed out in the front yard. Dave threw me over his shoulder and carted me upstairs to bed before our parents returned home from the movies. I press a kiss to his shoulder. Thank you for being here. I can't imagine doing this all by myself.
Please, as if I would let you.
He gives my arm a quick squeeze, then roots around in his seat pocket, tossing me the bag of Chex Mix he bought in the Atlanta terminal.
Here, Mom told me if I bring you back any skinnier, I'm grounded.
I smile, even though I'm pretty sure he's serious. Mom would tell him that, and I have lost some weight. After 6 days of almost no food, my denims hang loose on my hips. My stomach is taut and flat, and my ass, which has never been fat but certainly never been skinny either, looks like a shrinky-dink version of its former curvy self. Becoming a widow is good for 7 pounds and counting. I rip open the bag and nibble on one, and when my stomach doesn't revolt at the salty crunch, another, as I get my first glimpse of Seattle out the window. They don't call it the Emerald City for nothing. Miles and miles of rolling grass, leafy forests, and avocado-tinted lakes, reaching like long fingers into mossy valleys, made even greener by the infamous rain. Above us, clouds hang low and leaden into the distance. 15 minutes later, we're filing into the Seattle airport with our carry-ons and making our way via shuttle bus to the Hertz counter. Since we don't know exactly what we're looking for or how long we'll need to find it, Dave and I have decided to wing this trip. No car or hotel reservations, no plan. Not even a return ticket. Will's head would have exploded at the idea, but the travel websites assured us April's propensity for constant drizzle and Arctic winds meant tourists would stay away, and hotel rooms would be plentiful. We climb into the rental, and Dave starts the engine, gunning the gas until the vents spew warm air at our heads. Atlantans are not built for this kind of cold, the kind that whips across your skin and bites through to your bones, making you feel wet, even though you're not. I shiver in the passenger seat while Dave fiddles with the radio. He settles on a country station, the kind with Willie Nelson and lots of twang, and I pull up the driving directions on my iPhone. We need to get over to I-5 and then head north. When Dave doesn't hit the gas, I look over to see him watching me. What?
It's just...
He sighs, looking me square in the eye.
Are you absolutely positive you want to do this?
You're asking me now? He lifts both hands, lets them fall onto the steering wheel.
My timing isn't the best, I'll give you that. But yes, I'm asking you now, when there's still a chance for us to turn this thing around, to go home and forget all about whatever's here in Seattle, before it gets in the way of your husband's memory. Because it will, you know. Especially if what we find is bad, Have you considered that it might be?
Of course I've considered that it might be bad. In fact, I kind of assume it is. No man rewrites bits and pieces of their lives because those years were squeaky clean. He gives me a look that says touché.
Okay, so let me ask you this then. What if whatever we find isn't just bad? What if it's awful? No, what if it's DEFCON 1 awful? Without Will here to defend himself or explain, would you still want to know?
I gaze out over the parking lot and beyond, watching a jet soar skyward, while I consider my brother's question. Dave is right. I could still turn this thing around. I could climb out of this car, go back to the airport, and try to forget all about Will's past in Seattle. I could concentrate on remembering the good parts of my husband, that nobody could make me belly laugh harder, that he thought Sunday mornings were made for coffee in bed, that the sloping spot under his left ear seemed made for my nose, and try to ignore the rest. The parts he lied about, the parts of himself he hid. I could go home and get started mourning my husband. But how do you mourn a person you're no longer certain you know? I think of possible discoveries that would merit a DEFCON 1 rating. That Will has another family, a pretty wife, and two adorable toddlers with his square chin and slate blue eyes tucked away in a Seattle bungalow. That he's a wanted criminal, a serial killer, or a rapist, or a terrorist with a long list of murders to his name. Every theory I come up with is ridiculous. Anyone who wants to hide from a secret wife or the law does not put themselves up on Facebook. Then why all the lies? I don't have the first clue, but I do know I have to find out. I twist on the seat to face Dave. Yes, I still want to know.
You sure?
I nod, immediate and decisive. Positive. Without another word, he shoves the car into gear, punches the gas, and away we go. Once Dave has merged onto the highway, I punch in the number for ESP's head of human resources and hit the button for speakerphone.
Good morning, this is Shefali Majumdar speaking.
Except for her name, Shefali sounds as American as apple pie. Her voice is smooth and pleasant, without the slightest trace of an accent I can detect. Though once I explain why I'm calling, the awkwardness is hard to miss. So, basically, she says when I'm done, and there's new hesitation in her tone, what you're asking me is if I hired your husband?
That's correct.
Who was also one of the passengers on last week's Flight 23?
Unfortunately so.
And he never told you he was interviewing or even looking for a new job?
Exactly.
I only know because he told a friend he was offered a position at ESP, and that friend told me.
Shefali falls silent, and Dave and I exchange a worried look.
I lean back in the passenger seat and give her a moment to consider my request, my heart thunking against my ribs. I'm prepared to beg. I'm already gathering up the words in my head when she begins. Every human resources manual ever written would say that I can't tell you either way. That applicants for any position have an indisputable right to privacy, whether I hire them or not. If your husband didn't see fit to tell you about his job search, then ethically speaking, I can neither confirm nor deny that his search might have led him here. Disappointment spears me in the gut. I open my mouth to argue, but I've barely made a sound before Shefali cuts me off. What I can tell you is that ESP hasn't had a senior position opening in more than 8 months, and it was for VP of Marketing. Any technical positions we filled this past year, a software engineer would have been vastly overqualified for. Dave looks over, his eyes wide. I close mine, her message hitting me like a locomotive.
So you didn't hire him?
Her only answer is silence.
Did you speak to him recently about a job?
Shefali pauses,
but only for a second or two. Mrs. Griffith, up until 15 minutes ago, I'd never heard of him. Dave and I spend the rest of the drive bickering about what Shefali's words mean.
Why would Will lie?
Dave says for what must be the fifth time.
Why would he tell Corbin about a job he didn't even apply for, one that didn't even exist?
I give him the same answer as the last time he asked. Maybe it wasn't Will who lied. Maybe it was Corbin.
That makes no sense. What would Corbin have to gain by lying?
I don't know. The words come out harsher than I intended, because we've been having the same conversation for the past 15 minutes. I don't have answers for his endless questions. I don't know, I don't understand, and I can't fathom any reason either of them would have for lying. I'm saved from another round when Dave's phone beeps, indicating we've arrived at our destination. He hits the brakes in the middle of the street, gesturing beyond me out the window. Hancock High School is a massive complex of brick and mortar in Seattle's Central District, a downtown neighborhood on the confused end of gentrification. It's a neighborhood with multiple personality disorder, housing projects on one block, hulking renovated Victorians on another, boarded-up convenience stores on the next. We park on the street in front of the main entrance and make our way up the cement steps. Like any other school in the country, Hancock has had to respond to the rash of shootings and stabbings with increasingly drastic security protocols, especially in a neighborhood like this one. Theirs include locked doors, a camera whirring above our heads, and a uniformed guard stationed just inside, staring us down. I wave, and he buzzes us in.
"Can I help you?"
he says, standing so we can see that he's armed. I show him my Lake Forest badge, stamped with the school's emblem and featuring a full-color photograph of me, right above my title as school counselor. Lake Forest is a small enough school that staff are not actually required to wear them on campus, but I'm suddenly glad I keep mine in my bag. My name is Iris Griffith, and I'm a faculty member at Lake Forest Academy in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm looking into the background of one of your alums and was hoping to take a peek in your library. I assume that's where I'd find copies of all your old yearbooks. Sure enough, the man points us across the lobby to the main desk.
You'll need a visitor's pass first. Library is down the hall to your left. Can't miss it.
I thank him. And a few minutes later, Dave and I are bellying up to the library's information desk. The woman behind it is barely visible over the piles of books and papers, a leaning tower of brown boxes, and a computer screen so old it should be in a museum. She also looks nothing like a librarian. Her hair is a wild cloud of corkscrew curls. She's covered in leather and tattoos, and it's a good thing this school doesn't have metal detectors, because there's no way she'd make it through one with all those piercings. They line her lobes and nostrils and brows, and when she gives us a smile, two tiny silver balls peek out from under her top lip.
You're not students, she says, sizing us up. Let me guess. Journalists? College recruiters? Neighborhood activists?
I flash my Lake Forest badge, launch into my spiel, but she waves me off before I've gotten through the first sentence.
Bummer. I was really hoping you were recruiters. Our seniors are at a 62% college acceptance rate and holding, and if we don't raise it another 10% by graduation, I'm going to spend my summer months mowing lawns. Anyhow, what can I do for you guys?
We're looking for a copy of your old yearbooks, 1999, maybe a year or two before.
Who are you looking for?
My husband. I swallow down a searing pain that I know must melt my features. His name was Will Griffith. One of her brows arches at my use of the past tense, but she doesn't ask for details. She pushes to a stand, gestures for us to follow her down to the right, to where an open and bright reading area darkens into the stacks.
Name's India, by the way.
I'm Iris, and this is my brother Dave. Thanks for your help, India.
No problem.
She walks fast, her motorcycle boots making dull thunks on the ratty carpet, talking the entire time over her shoulder.
Hancock opened its doors in the 20s, but the first yearbook didn't appear until 1937. I guess it took them that long to get their you-know-what together.
Back then, we weren't much more than a 12-room building with a couple hundred students, most of them Jewish, Japanese, or Italian. She gestures to the far wall of framed photographs, dozens and dozens of more recent graduating classes, a sea of brown and tan faces, punctuated by the occasional light-skinned one. I stop and scan them for the class of 1999. The picture's too high for me to pick out well, but it's the same racial makeup, more dark than light. India takes a hard right into the stacks, stopping at a shelf packed with hard burgundy covers, many of them held together by scotch tape. What year did you say you were looking for? Graduating class of 1999. Oh, that's right. The year we got our first National Merit Scholar, our football team took state, and a burst pipe flooded the gym right in the middle of a basketball game. At our raised brows, she lifts a shoulder. I'm the unofficial school historian. Comes with the territory of running a library, I guess. Anyway, she runs a black-painted fingernail down the spines until she finds the right one, then pulls it out and hands it to me. Here you go. There are a couple of tables around the corner. Take as long as you need. I'll be holding down the fort up front. Dave thanks her, and I carry the book with shaking hands to a table at the end of the stacks. The design is classic 90s. Fat, gold letters, and the outline of a wildcat on satiny maroon, and the few bites of Chex Mix in my belly push up the back of my throat. I shove the book at my brother. I can't. You look. We sit, and I study the tabletop's ballpoint graffiti while Dave flips through the yearbook's pages. He stops on a spread of seniors, full-color shots of kids in burgundy caps and gowns, the bright gold tassels hanging alongside smiling cheeks. Only Will, the only white face on the page, is not smiling. Sorry, Iris. It's him. Dave turns the book around so I can see. William Matthew Griffith. It's Will, all right. His hair is lighter, and his face is thinner, but his eyes are as familiar to me as my own. The sight of him there, here, in a Seattle yearbook, hits me like a visceral punch. I press a hand to my churning stomach and try to think through what I know. Okay, so clearly the bit about growing up in Memphis was a lie. We don't know that. Maybe he only transferred here for his senior year, Dave says, playing devil's advocate. Hang on, let me get the earlier years. He jumps up from his chair and heads back into the stacks. But Will's picture is there, too, and in all three, scowling at the camera, in a way I've never seen him do, not even when our flight back from Cancun was delayed 5 times in 12 hours. Dave rests a hand on the back of my chair, leans in to inspect the pictures. Why does he look so angry? Because that's what he was. His dad was dead, and his mom was sick. She died his junior year. On top of school and caring for her, he was working 2 jobs, running the house, and paying all the bills. As I say the words, it occurs to me that any or all of this could have been a lie, too. At least, that's what he always claimed. Dave sinks into his chair, reaching for the 1999 yearbook, the one where Will was a senior. He taps the white space under his picture. How come everybody else has a favorite quote and list of extracurriculars, but there's nothing under Will's name? Wasn't he some kind of wrestling champion? Dave flips to the wrestling page, and there's no Will. It never occurred to me to question him. But now that I think about it, when would Will have had time for the wrestling team? I press both hands to my churning stomach and swallow down a surge of sick. Who is this man I married? Dave leans back in his chair, running a palm through his dark hair. Okay, let's think this through. 1999 isn't that long ago. I'll bet you at least one of his teachers is still working here. Maybe they'd remember him. India might know someone we could ask. I reach for my bag and stand. Dave gathers up the yearbooks. You go ahead. I'll put these back and meet you up front. I find her behind the information desk, sorting returned books onto a rickety cart. She looks up when she hears me coming. Did you find what you needed? Sort of. I was wondering if any of the teachers who were here in 1999 are still here now. Oh, sure. A bunch of them. You wanted to see if one of them remembered your husband? I nod. Well, she leans on the cart and thinks for a moment, and then her face brightens. I'm pretty sure the baseball coach graduated from Hancock in 1999. I don't know if he knew your husband, but he'd be the best place to start. She checks her watch, taps the face twice with a finger. You have about an hour before practice starts, which means you can probably find him in the gym. Chapter 13. Dave and I find a man matching Coach Miller's description in a dim hallway at the back of Hancock High's gym, lugging a metal basket of baseballs into the hall. Above his head, a lone tube light buzzes and hums. Are you Coach Miller? I ask, moving close enough to get a good whiff of his cologne. The man is bathed in it, an overwhelming stench that burns the back of my throat, especially when combined with the other odors hanging in the air. Ben Gay and sweaty socks. He looks up, his eyes half hidden under the bill of a Hancock High baseball cap.
Yep.
India wasn't kidding when she said he was built like a linebacker. Coach Miller is massive, 6 feet and then some, of bulky bones and fat-padded muscle, under baggy street clothes, jeans, and a long-sleeved polo. He ducks back into the room, reappearing 2 seconds later with another basket, this time filled with mitts. The librarian told us you graduated from Hancock in 1999.
Yeah, that's right.
He locks the door with a key he drops into his back jeans pocket.
Who's asking?
My name is Iris, and this is my brother Dave. We were hoping you could tell us what you remember about a former classmate of yours, Will Griffith?
Nope, don't know him.
He leans down, reaching for one of the baskets. I slide my phone from my pocket and wake it up, revealing a picture of me and Will. This is him, William Matthew Griffith. Do you recognize him? With a loud sigh, he glances at my screen, then drops the basket and looks again.
Him? That's Billy Griffith.
My heart flips over. Do you remember him?
Everybody who went to Hancock back then remembers Billy Griffith.
He cocks his head, and his eyes narrow in suspicion.
Who did you say you were again?
Iris Griffith, his wife. The coach gives a surprised puff, quick and sharp enough to stir up the hair on the left side of my face.
No way.
Excuse me?
It's just...
He gives me a slow head to toe, lingering on my curviest spots in a way that makes it hard to stand still, then follows it up with a grin, and I'm confused by the incongruity. His gaze was appreciative, but his smile isn't the least bit friendly.
You don't really seem like his type.
Maybe not, but I know this guy's type. The type who, once upon a time, was the one every boy wanted to be, and every girl wanted to date. The type who swaggered through the hallways with a ball and an empty backpack, never once thinking beyond next week's game. The type I warn my students at Lake Forest Academy not to become. I park my tone in neutral. How so?
Do you have a weapon in your purse or your back pocket? Do you hear voices in your head telling you to, I don't know, light fires and slash tires?
Indignation burns, hot and sudden, at his question, but I keep my expression in check.
Of course not. See? Not his type.
He leans down, swipes the basket of balls from the floor.
Now, if you'll excuse me, I've got to get ready for practice.
Without waiting for a reply, he turns and takes off down the hall. I shoot Dave a confused look, and he shrugs. Together, we set off after the coach. Coach Miller, wait! He doesn't wait, doesn't even slow. His long legs take 2 steps to my one, and I have to jog to catch up. Please, I only need 10 minutes of your time. I don't know if you've heard, but my husband was a passenger on that plane that just crashed, and I...
Look, lady,
he says, whirling around so fast I almost slam into him.
I am the last person you ought to be asking about Billy Griffith. I don't like to speak ill of the dead, which means I'm not going to say anything. You do the math.
I'm not asking you to sugarcoat your memories. I'm only looking for the truth. He shakes his head, slow and stubborn.
He and I were not friends. We didn't run in the same circles, and we didn't get along. I don't know what else to tell you.
Tell me what he was like. Tell me how long you've known him, and who his friends were, and where he lived. Tell me everything you can think of, because... Still shaking his head, Coach Miller takes a step back, and then another, his big body gearing up for a retreat, and I can tell I'm about to lose him. I take a deep breath and will myself to keep going, to tell this stranger what I'm really asking. Because my husband lied, okay? He lied to me about a lot of things. He told me that he was en route to Orlando, not Seattle, when that plane crashed. I had no idea he'd ever been in this city. All along, I thought he was from Memphis. What does a Memphis accent sound like? The question slices through my mind, sudden and unexpected. Will didn't have much of a southern accent, especially not compared to mine, and he never really used any of the slang southerners are so fond of. Maybe that's just not how they talk in Memphis. I have no idea. Coach Miller stops moving, and his brows disappear under the bill of his ball cap.
Billy told you he grew up in Memphis?
Yes. The coach leans back, squinting at me down his nose.
Now that sounds like something he would do.
He puffs a sigh of defeat, shoves the basket of balls at Dave's chest, doubles back for the mitts, and motions for us to follow him.
Practice starts in half an hour, so you'll have to walk with me.
He leads us deeper into the maze of hallways behind the gym, talking over his shoulder.
Like I said before, I remember Billy Griffith, but not because he was such a great guy. He was the type of guy that when he came walking down the hall, everybody all of a sudden had something very important to dig out of their lockers. You understand what I'm telling you? Anybody who looked him in the eye got singled out, and nobody wanted to get singled out by Billy Griffith. Not even the teachers.
Why? Dave says.
What happened if he singled you out? Sometimes a shove or a busted lip. Sometimes nothing until days later. That was the scariest thing about Billy. His unpredictability. The only thing you could count on was that he'd turn on you eventually. He was mean and he was angry, and his parents were too busy beating the crap out of each other to care.
His parents. His father, he said, died when he was two. His mother, he claimed, raised him on her own. What ages are we talking about here? I say, as we turn the corner onto a row of windowed offices. How long ago did you know Will... Billy? Coach Miller thinks for a moment.
Well, I moved to Rainier Vista the summer before second grade. So what's that? 7 or so?
His answer ties a knot in my throat, because that's when the truth hits home. Memphis was a lie, not a fib, not an exaggeration, not a little white lie or a half-truth, an intentionally false statement meant to deceive. Will never lived in Memphis. I'm not certain he ever set foot there. No wonder we spent our first anniversary in Nashville instead. Rage coils in my belly, writhing only a second or two before it bursts to the blistering surface at the memory of Will's silence on that surprise drive to Memphis. I think about the panic he must have felt at my accidental excavation of his lie, how he must have been scrambling to come up with an explanation, finally settling on the excuse that his Memphis memories were too painful to relive. I bought it without question, turning the car around without second thought. And now, walking down a dingy, smelly hallway in Will's real alma mater, I feel like a fool. We stop at an office door, and Coach Miller shoves it open with a giant paw. He ushers us into a tiny and neatly cluttered room, with papers and charts and boxes of sporting equipment stacked in tidy columns along the wall. He takes the basket from Dave, sets it on the floor by the door, and offers us a seat in the pair of ratty chairs in front of his desk. I fall into mine and try to breathe around the fireball in my chest. Coach Miller sits, digs his heels into the carpet, and rolls himself up to the desk, his chair wheels squealing like nails over a chalkboard. He does a little double take when he catches my expression.
You okay?
Somehow, my voice finds its way outside my head, and it sounds only slightly strangled.
I'm fine. Please, continue.
Okay,
he says, but in a way that tells me he's not totally convinced. He takes off his cap, rubs a palm over his tight curls, and sets it back.
Like I was saying, nobody at home was disciplining him, which means he pretty much did whatever he pleased and got away with it, both in school and out. He fought. He stole stuff. He dealt drugs in the hallways and on street corners. He skipped so many classes, I don't know how he ever graduated, because the teachers wanted him gone, probably.
Coach Miller's revelations are like a string of mini explosions in my head, one on top of the other, leaving me breathless and dizzy.
Will told me his father died when he was a baby, I say. He said he had no memory of him.
Wishful thinking, probably. Mr. Griffith was a mean old drunk, but it was his mother who died, as I recall, sometime during our junior year.
I think back to the first time Will told me of her death, the only time I ever saw him cry. Malignant melanoma, he said, caught after it had already metastasized to her brain, liver, and lungs. An awful, painful death.
Cancer?
As soon as I say it, I wish I could go back and fix my tone, make it sound less gullible wife, more certain. Surely, Will couldn't have faked a tale that emotional. No one is that good an actor. But Coach Miller barks a laugh.
Hardly. She died in a fire. Oh, my God, Dave says. That poor woman. Poor Will.
Coach Miller leans back in his chair, his weight bouncing it around a few times before it finds stillness.
Poor Billy, huh? Let me tell you something. Every kid in our neighborhood was dealing with some kind of crap at home. Addictions, arrests, deadbeat dads all over the place. But we were finding a way to deal with them. Billy didn't even try. He just got angry and mean.
Dave and I exchange a frown, and I can tell he's thinking what I am. How does a drug-dealing street punk become a college-educated, loving husband? I clear my throat against a sudden onslaught of emotions leapfrogging up my chest. Sadness for Will's lonely childhood and his mother's violent death. Resentment for parents who couldn't stop slinging fists long enough to love on their son. Indignation at whatever higher power dealt Will such a crappy hand. Fury, I'm only finding out about it now.
Whatever happened to his father,
I somehow manage.
I heard rumors he's sick. Something needing full-time care, but...
Coach Miller lifts both hands, lets them fall with a thunk to the desk.
My mom used to keep me updated on neighborhood gossip, but she died a couple years ago.
Dave and I fall silent. When we were young, Mom always told us there were three sides to every argument. Our side, the other side, and, somewhere in the middle, the truth. Maybe this is what Dave meant when he asked if I was sure I wanted to know about Will. Without him here to defend himself from Coach Miller's tale, I can't gauge where the middle falls. But that doesn't mean I'm about to swallow this story whole. Coach Miller is clearly holding on to his grudge with both gigantic fists, and for events that went down almost 2 decades ago. He takes in our doubtful expressions and grunts, shoving away from the desk.
Believe me, don't believe me. Doesn't change the fact that Billy Griffith was a spiteful, sneaky thug who could come up behind you, stab you with a knife, and leave before you even notice the blood. Ask around. I'm sure you'll have a hard time finding anybody to say otherwise. Now, I gotta get to practice before those punks destroy my diamond.
He stands and stalks past us, forgetting all about the baskets of equipment in his hurry to get to the door. He stops himself halfway into the hall, his big hand gripping the door jamb.
Do you believe in karma? Because that's the first thing I thought when I heard what happened to Billy.
Dave and I backtrack our way through the corridors of Hancock High, both of us trying to make sense of Coach Miller's story. I wanted a toe dip into my husband's life. What I got was more like a full-body dunking into Arctic waters, and it's left me shell-shocked and numb.
"Did you believe him?"
I say, as we turn the corner onto a wall of dingy and dented lockers under a giant banner. "Go Wildcats! Stay fierce!" Dave lifts a shoulder, and his mouth scrunches into a tight squiggle I know all too well. He doesn't want to, but he believes at least part of what we heard.
"We could check with the local police station. If Will really was dealing drugs, maybe he got into trouble. The police might have it on record."
"I guess,"
I sigh, my shoulders sagging toward the dingy floor. "And I get that Will wouldn't want to talk about his mother's death. I get it. But that story he fed me about her dying of cancer? I cried, Dave. Real tears. He had all the medical jargon down, too. Knew all the symptoms and details of how the cancer progressed. You can't just make something like that up. He must have spent weeks researching melanoma on the web. I mean, you have to really commit to a lie like that one." At the stairwell, Dave shoves open the door, stepping aside to let me pass.
"I'd imagine so."
"And, okay, so his father wasn't the nicest person. That's not something he would have liked to talk about either. But why not just say they were estranged? Why lie and tell me he never knew him?"
"You're the psychologist here. What would make a person fictionalize the first 18 years of their life?"
"Or more. After these past few days, I'm no longer assuming anything from the time before I met him. I'm not saying I believe everything Coach Miller said, but he described a deeply troubled kid. And even if only part of his story was true, you don't bounce back from something like that, if at all, without serious therapy. Which is why I need more than just one eyewitness account. I need to talk to their old neighbors, find some more teachers and classmates. Coach Miller can't be the only one who remembers him." Dave nods his agreement, and we emerge from the stairwell at the front of the building. From his spot by the entrance, the guard gives us a chin lift.
"You find what you needed?"
"Yes,"
Dave says. At the same time, I hook a thumb back into the belly of the building, in the direction of the library. "Let's go take another look at the yearbook. Better yet, let's make some copies."
"No need."
"What? Why?" He flashes me a zip-it look, leaning in close and talking through gritted teeth.
"I'll fill you in the car."
The guard grunts like he couldn't care either way.
"Sign out before you go."
Dave signs us out, and we head out the front door into a biting cold. Sometime while we were inside, steel-colored clouds rolled in on a front that dropped the temperature a good 10 degrees. I shiver and tug my coat higher around my neck, but Dave unzips his, pulling the 1999 yearbook from behind his back with a cocky smile. My eyes go wide. "You stole it?" He purses his lips.
"I prefer to think of it as borrowing."
"India won't see it that way. And when she notices it missing, she'll know exactly who took it, too. Our names are on the visitor's log, Dave."
"Stop worrying. Borrowing implies giving it back as soon as we've made ourselves a copy. We'll put it back before India even notices it's gone."
"You don't know that. What if she does? What if she tracks me back to Lake Forest?" He rolls his eyes.
"Isn't it difficult, walking around with your panties in such a wad?"
I love my brother, but here's where we're different. I live in a world where rules are meant to be followed, whereas he thinks rules are mostly an inconvenience, especially the ones that inconvenience him. Dave puts his feet up on chairs and cuts through parking lots and brings his own snacks into movie theaters, all without ever getting caught. It's all about attitude, he would say, and he's not wrong. Dave has a boldness tucked inside him that draws people in and makes them forget he just stepped on their toes in order to push to the front of the line. At the top of the stairs, the school doors slam open and a throng of teenagers spills out. They hit the steps and scatter, moving at us with a speed and energy that can only come after being cooped up in a classroom for over 8 hours. Dave grabs my wrist, drags me in the direction of the street.
"Come on, before we get trampled."
We're a block away, stepping into the rental, when my phone rings with a number I don't recognize. I press it to my ear. Hello? A woman's voice, high and brisk, greets me.
Iris Griffith?
Yes. My name is Leslie Thomas. I'm calling from the Family Assistance Center. What happened to Margaret Ann?
Ann Margaret,
Dave whispers. He starts the car, but doesn't shift it into gear. On the other end of the line, the caller doesn't miss a beat.
Margaret Ann is currently unavailable, but I was hoping I could ask you a few questions.
My attention snags, just for a second, on the name. Ann Margaret or Margaret Ann? Either way, this woman has caught me off guard.
Sorry, I'm not really in a place to talk right now.
This won't take but a minute or two. I understand that a number of families have banded together and are bringing a wrongful death lawsuit against Liberty Air. Are you one of them?
Both her question and her tone, high-strung and almost manic, send all sorts of warning bells ringing in my head. Why would anyone at the FAC, an organization that exists under the Liberty Air umbrella, ask such a thing?
I frown at Dave, whose brows shoot skyward.
What?
He mouths.
I don't know, I say into the phone.
You don't know if you're one of the families suing Liberty Air? No, I don't know anything about the lawsuit.
Who did you say you were again?
My name is Leslie Thomas. This morning, the Miami Herald reported that the pilot was coming off a 3-day bachelor party in South Beach and was functioning on only 1 hour of sleep. If that's true, will you and the other families be charging Liberty Air with manslaughter?
Something icy steals around my heart, racking my torso with a chill that's not from the cold. The pilot was half asleep, possibly hungover? The blood drains from my cheeks, and I press a palm to my churning stomach.
Dave frowns.
What's wrong?
But wait, why would someone at the Family Assistance Center be telling me this? Aren't they supposed to be protecting the interests of Liberty Air?
Who are you again? My name is Leslie Thomas. And you're calling from the FAC?
That's correct.
Then why are you questioning me like a journalist?
Silence. I hear her gearing up for another pitch, but it's too late. I already have her number.
Because you are a journalist, I say in an angry hiss, which means you're also a liar.
I punch end on my screen and begin filling Dave in, but almost immediately my phone rings again and from the same number.
Do you know how to block this person?
Dave takes the phone from my fingers. He's fiddling with the screen when it lights up with a text. I lean across the middle console and frown at the message on my screen. Go home, Iris.
Who sent that?
I say. Dave tries to pull up the number, but it's blocked. His thumbs type out a quick reply.
Who is this?
He hits send, and we watch my screen for a reply, waking it up with a fingertip whenever it starts to fade to black.
Why would somebody be telling you to go home?
Dave says.
I don't know. Who else knows you're here?
Our parents and James, full stop. I haven't talked to any of my girlfriends since the memorial, and I didn't tell Ted or anyone at school I was leaving, only that I was taking a week or two off.
Dave thinks for a moment. Well, if it's somebody back in Atlanta, wouldn't they have said, come home instead?
I nod, right as another text pings my phone. Someone who knows what you're looking for, and it's not in Seattle. Chapter 14. Across the lake in Bellevue, Dave and I begin at a Best Buy, our best shot of tracing the blocked number on my phone. After that second text came in, someone who knows what you're looking for, and it's not in Seattle, the errand shimmied up to top priority. Neither of us misses the irony. If Will were here, he'd unearth the number in 30 seconds flat. The kid behind the Geek Squad counter looks to be about 20 or so, the type of guy who Will always claimed gave techies a bad name. Greasy hair, pimply face, bushy eyebrows, and a prominent overbite. Behind his Coke bottle glasses, his eyes go comically wide.
You're asking me to hack another person's phone number?
The geek says, shaking his head.
I can't do that.
Can't? Dave gives him a charming smile. Or won't.
Irrelevant. I'm only allowed to repair and install.
My brother peels 520s from his wallet and fans them across the countertop.
Are you sure about that?
The kid's not sure. His gaze flicks from us to the cash, and the struggle is real. $100 can buy a lot of gigabytes.
He whips his head left and right, taking note of a colleague ringing up a purchase at the register, another hunched over a MacBook at the far end of the counter. When neither of them looks his way, he swipes the bills and my phone from the counter, pocketing both.
BRB,
he says, and then he disappears through a door marked employees only. While he's gone, I head over to the computer display and pull up the internet. What was it Coach Miller called that neighborhood where he lived? Rainier something.
View? No, that's not right.
Dave thinks for a second or two, then snaps.
Vista. Rainier Vista.
That's it. I look up the neighborhood and scribble a couple cross streets in a notebook I carry in my bag, then do the same with the nearest FedEx and police department.
While you're at it, find us a decent restaurant. I haven't eaten since Atlanta, and I'm starved.
For my brother, decent means complicated dishes and wine pairings, both of which means dinner takes forever. I shake my head. We can stop at the first drive-thru we come to, but I want to keep moving. He wrinkles his nose.
You're seriously suggesting we order food at a window and eat it out of a paper bag?
Yes, because I still want to see Will's old neighborhood and talk to somebody at the police department before the day's over. And we can't do that if you order the 7-course chef's tasting menu, which I know you will.
Seriously, Iris, I have to eat something. The low blood sugar is making me lightheaded.
Would you stop being such a drama queen? I already told you we can...
Sir? The text was sent from a messaging app.
Okay. Dave and I say in unison, and in exactly the same tone. Not okay as in we're done here, but okay as in go on. The geek assumes the former. He plunks down my phone and turns to go.
Wait,
I say. What about the number?
The app encrypts and then destroys the text, as well as where the text originated.
He shoves his glasses up his nose with a knuckle.
Think of it as a Snapchat for text messaging. Only, you don't have to reveal any identifying information in order to begin a conversation.
Meaning?
Meaning it's impossible to trace the number. Sorry.
He moves down the counter to help an old lady clutching a laptop to her chest. Disappointment, sharp and instant, stabs me between the ribs.
Now what?
I say, turning to my brother. Dave sighs, watching the geek go.
Now you owe me $100.
I bribe Dave with the rest of my checks mix and an 8:30 reservation at Atmosphere, which, according to Zagat, is one of Seattle's best French restaurants overlooking the Puget Sound. With minimal griping, he steers the rental back across the lake to Rainier Vista.
Are you sure this is it?
He says, slowing in the middle of the street.
The way Coach Miller described it. I was expecting something much slummier.
I check the street sign against the address in my notebook. This is the right place, but you're right. It's way nicer than I thought it would be. Rainier Vista is not Beverly Hills, but it's no slum either. To our right are small but colorful houses with sweeping front porches. To our left are townhomes and a block-sized park, empty but for a pristine basketball court and a long line of trees. The setting sun lights them up from behind, bare limbs reaching into the leaden sky. I twist on my seat, searching for the promised view. But if Mount Rainier is visible from here, it's tucked behind a thick layer of red-tinged clouds. Dave pulls over, hitting the button to roll down my window.
Hi there,
he says, leaning across me to speak to the young couple on the sidewalk. Two kids, barely out of high school, their features hidden under thick hoods. His arm is slung around her shoulders in a gesture that hits me as more possessive than protective.
Do you guys live around here?
They don't stop walking, don't even turn their heads our way. The girl flicks her eyes in my direction, but her boyfriend hustles her along. Dave eases the car forward, dialing up the dazzle on his smile.
We're new to the area, and we were hoping you could give us a little bit of direction.
The pair makes a sharp right, veering away from us down a footpath bordering an empty park.
Or maybe not.
Friendly neighborhood. Dave puffs an ironic laugh, then looks around, taking in the neighborhood.